Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Let's start with our public health news and research roundup. Okay, what do we have here? I've just been delivered a memo to Dan Rutt, host, Just for the Health of It, from WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, regarding Public Health News and Research Roundup. Attention listeners, please note that this Public Health News and Research Roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto, hereinafter referred to as Evil Chemical Company Number 1. Also, please note that unlike the herbicide Roundup, this Public Health News and Research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen. Well, on that note, I'd like to start with a story from the Lansing State Journal, how a decades-old environmental crisis could help Michigan lawmakers prevent next disaster. The Flint water crisis wasn't the first environmental disaster to put Michigan in the limelight. Michigan became the site of the most widespread agricultural disaster in U.S. history in the 1970s. That's when livestock feed contaminated with PBB, a man-made chemical once added to plastics to make them fire-resistant, was accidentally distributed to farms throughout the state. Millions were exposed to the dangerous chemical, and the impact is still studied today. Now, I have a personal connection to this story. I grew up in St. Louis, Michigan, where Michigan Chemical, the chemical company which produced the PBBs that contaminated millions of people, that same chemical plant produced DDT, an environmental disaster of a chemical that has contaminated the entire surface of the planet. The Michigan Chemical plant was on the waterfront of the Pine River. I grew up in a house on the bank of the Pine River, a mile downstream from the chemical plant. We used to fish a lot, but we knew not to eat the fish. There was lots of pollution in the river, visible to even an elementary age kid, though I had little understanding of the true dangers. My guess is that the adults also had a poor understanding of the true dangers. Ironically, my dad would pay us a nickel a fish so we could use them as fertilizer in the family garden. So, we were likely contaminating our food anyways, with the likes of PBBs and DDT. St. Louis, Michigan, at one point in its history, was known for its crystal-pure spring waters. Now it's known as an EPA Superfund site, a toxic waste dump, costing billions of dollars for cleanup in a town of only a few thousand people and one too many corporate citizens. Of course, the chemical plant shed its legal liability through bankruptcy laws, leaving taxpayers with the bill at over $100,000 per resident. What a waste. What a toxic waste. Now, back to the news story. There are lessons to be learned, said Marcus, an Emory University professor who had studied PBB for about 20 years. Even chemicals not intended for animal or human consumption could end up in the food supply. She said public officials should listen when people say something is wrong with their food, water, or environment, because the earlier a problem is detected, the sooner it can be contained. And they should keep track of the people affected to help them mitigate damage and study the long-term effects of exposure to a chemical. PBBs, or polybrominated biphenyls, are fire retardants no longer in production. In the 1970s, they were used in things like plastics, televisions, textiles, and other consumer products. The chemical was inadvertently mixed into livestock feed and distributed around the state. Between 6 and 8 million Michigan residents ate meat, milk, and eggs tainted with the chemical before it was removed from the food supply. Michigan residents had above average levels of the chemical in their blood as recently as 2004, the CDC found. That's because PBB is long-lasting, showing the persistence some chemicals can have when they get into our bodies, our food supply, and the environment. High exposure has been shown to cause increased rates of breast cancer, miscarriage, less healthy babies, early menstruation, low estrogen levels, genital and uterine issues, and abnormal thyroid function. Those dosages could have been lower. Farmers noticed strange behavior and poor health in their animals that ate the PBB-tainted feed, but the authorities didn't listen to the farmers' pleas or recognize the chemical right away. Initial tests didn't pick up the contamination, since regulators were looking for common agricultural chemicals and not industrial ones like PBB. A farmer worked for about a year to uncover the contamination with the help of a private lab, but the chemical had spread through Michigan by the time the state recognized his findings and quarantined farms. Lesson one, listen when people complain. In Flint, residents were discounted when they complained about the taste and smell of their water in 2014, after officials, in a cost-saving effort, switched the city's water source and kicked off the lead poisoning disaster. It took well over a year for the state to acknowledge lead in the city's water. When the Flint water contamination story came out, many of the people in the PBB registry were outraged. Didn't we learn from PBB? Why are we ignoring people who know that there's something wrong in their environment? Those impacted groups also shouldn't be ignored once the contamination is exposed. Their experience could help lawmakers and public health officials prevent future crises. Lesson 2, keep track of the people impacted. Emory University scientists have been studying PBB since the late 70s. Scientists used Michigan's cancer registry to uncover the association with PBB exposure and breast cancer. Lesson 3, focus on preventing chemical problems. Federal chemical regulation policies can hamstring states like Michigan when it comes to preventing environmental contamination. Chemicals don't always get tested for safety before they are used in consumer products. States can set up limits on the amount of a certain chemical allowed in drinking water, for example, but those limits are hard to set without federal review of those chemicals. Prevention is better than reaction, especially with chemicals like PBB. They are incredibly difficult to manage when they're in the environment. The more you can focus on prevention, the better. Next up, a story from the Miami Herald. Dolphins poisoned by algae also showed signs of Alzheimer's-like brain disease. Well, for those of us living in algae-toxic environments occasionally, like in Toledo here, there's a good one for us. Toxins produced by blue-green algae that have increasingly polluted Florida waters have been found in dead dolphins that also showed signs of Alzheimer's-like brain disease, according to a new study led by University of Miami researchers. The study concludes that dolphins and their complex brains could provide a key sentinel for the potential threat from toxic algae blooms to humans. The findings add to a growing body of research that focuses on the health threat from harmful algae blooms, which climate scientists warn could worsen as the planet warms. South Florida is particularly vulnerable, with miles of coast and an agricultural industry and swelling population that continue to feed blooms with pollution from fertilizer and sewage. 2 years ago, University of Miami researchers confirmed high levels of toxin from algae in sharks, concluding that the ocean's big, long-living predators accumulate the toxin in their brains over time, and they warned against eating shark. Making the connection in dolphins is significant because it provides a window into a more complex brain than a shark's, he said, and one with higher functions, like a human's. If you have these dolphins feeding on the same marine food web as humans, potentially eating the same things as humans. That's why we say it serves as a sentinel. Next up, another one on climate change from Anthropocene Magazine. There's your word for the day. Titled, "This is How Climate Change Takes a Toll on the Heart." Doctors know that cold temperatures can trigger heart attacks, but the effect of hot weather on heart attack risk has been more difficult to establish. Now, a team of German researchers had found evidence that heat-induced heart attacks are increasing, suggesting that climate change poses a risk to cardiovascular health. The heat-related heart attack risk was especially prominent among people with pre-existing cardiovascular disease, diabetes, or high cholesterol. The prevalence of these biological risk factors has increased in the population over time, illustrating that the health effects of climate change don't occur in isolation. Climate change can be a risk in itself, but can also exacerbate other public health problems. In a warming climate, won't more heat-induced heart attacks be balanced out by fewer cold-induced ones? The current study suggests that this isn't necessarily the case. There was no significant change in cold-induced heart attacks over the study period. That suggests climate change could increase the burden of temperature-related heart attacks overall. Of course, this also plays into one of the common misunderstandings about so-called global warming, which is probably better defined as global climate instability, where actually you have greater bouts of hot temperatures, but you also have greater bouts of cold spells. So if anything, we'll probably see more cold-induced heart attacks. Next up, from the Washington Post, fentanyl drug overdose deaths rising most sharply among African Americans. The synthetic opioid fentanyl has been driving up the rate of fatal drug overdoses across racial and social lines in the United States, with the sharpest increase among African Americans, according to a new analysis by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The death rate among African Americans from fentanyl-involved drug overdoses rose 141% each year on average from 2011 to 2016. The death rate for Hispanics rose 118% in that period every year on average, and 61% for non-Hispanic whites. From 2014 through 2016, the male death rate spiked to 8.6 per 100,000 compared to 3.1 for women. And I just want to note here that elsewhere this has been reported and attributed to the fact that males are more likely than females to either use drugs alone, they're less likely to seek help, and also when people, drug users or former drug users are released from prison, which is predominantly male, and they get out and they use for the first time, they're particularly vulnerable to an overdose. Okay, back to the story. The opioid epidemic has roots in overprescription of powerful painkillers such as oxycodone and an underappreciation of their addictive potential. Earlier this decade, after the crackdown on illicit clinics known as pill mills, many people who were addicted to prescription drugs switched to heroin, and overdoses surged in many communities. Then, synthetic fentanyl, which is 50 times more potent than heroin, flooded the country from Mexico and China, often delivered by U.S. mail. Their report represents the first time the CDC has managed to isolate the role of fentanyl in the drug epidemic that is killing about 70,000 Americans a year. A separate report released this month by the CDC, tracking monthly changes in the number of overdose deaths from all drugs, shows the death rate has stabilized for the past year and a half. This suggests that the epidemic has plateaued at an extraordinarily high level. The new report shows that this is an epidemic overwhelmingly east of the Mississippi River, and particularly acute in New England, where street heroin historically has been like fentanyl sold in powdered form, such that the two drugs are easily blended. In the western U.S., heroin typically has been sold in the form of black tar and is not as easily blended with fentanyl, although that may be changing due to innovations in the illicit drug trade. Next up, from Cleveland.com, federal government approves Ohio Medicaid work requirements. The federal government approved a request from Ohio to require Medicaid expansion enrollees to prove that they've worked 20 hours a week to receive health care. If people aren't working 20 hours a week, they need to show they're engaged in other activities, including a job search, education, job training, or community service. There are exceptions to the work requirement. People age 50 and older, people who are caregivers, and individuals with chronic conditions. The federal government notes Ohio is the ninth state to receive approval to require Medicaid enrollees work. According to the Ohio Department of Medicaid, 58% of expansion enrollees already work, but they are low-wage jobs that don't offer health care. As of November, 2.8 million people were enrolled in Ohio Medicaid. About 690,000 were part of the Medicaid expansion group. The state estimates about 36,000 people will not be eligible for Medicaid under the work requirements. Critics say that number is too low. It's not like the waiver comes along and is operational on day one. There is a lot of work the state has to do to set everything up. The work requirements are not expected to go into effect until January 1st, 2021. This policy will erode the Medicaid expansion, hurting low-wage and seasonal workers in construction, retail, food service, and hospitality, Wendy Patton, Senior Project Director for Policy Matters Ohio, a left-leaning think tank, said in a prepared statement. Research shows that additional reporting or administrative burdens create barriers to eligible people retaining coverage. Many working and even disabled people who are supposed to be exempted will lose coverage because of reporting requirements. Community Solutions estimates the new work requirement would cost county governments $380 million over a five-year period because of the administrative burden. Will this be an unfunded mandate that requires counties to financially support? Is this a budget-neutral initiative if it costs counties local funds to implement? When the state implemented similar work requirements for SNAP, the food stamp program, it estimated 134,000 people would lose eligibility. In reality, nearly 370,000 Ohioans were disenrolled. And putting additional administrative responsibilities on already swamped counties could create a bottleneck for the entire Medicaid system, which covers pregnant women and children, among other vulnerable populations. I'd just like to note that the state's predicting 36,000 people kicked off the Medicaid because of this work requirement. And if you look at about $75 million a year just to administer getting people off the program, that comes out to over $2,000 per person kicked off the program. The average Medicaid cost in Ohio is about $7,000 per person. And actually, the people that would be kicked off would probably tended to be a little bit healthier because people with chronic diseases and somewhat older people, people over 50, would be exempt from the work requirement. So you're probably talking, it would cost you about a third of what it's costing to give people health insurance to make sure that they don't get health insurance. That doesn't seem like a particularly great idea to me. Okay, let's go for a little more lighthearted in a segment I'd like to call Only in America. From the Des Moines Register, with assist from the USA Today, our source of hard news, MillerCoors escalates corn syrup war with lawsuit against rival Anheuser-Busch. What began as a marketing battle on Super Bowl Sunday between beer giants has turned litigious. MillerCoors, owner of the Miller Lite and Coors Lite brands, is suing fellow beer conglomerate Anheuser-Busch, brewer Budweiser, Bud Light, and Busch Light. The lawsuit accuses Anheuser-Busch of launching a false and misleading advertising campaign targeting Miller Lite and Coors Light in order to deceive beer consumers into believing that there is corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup in Miller Lite and Coors Light to increase sales of Bud Light. Anheuser-Busch's fear-mongering over a common beer ingredient it uses in many of its own beers as a fermentation aid that is not even present in the final product, Miller's Coors said in a statement. Oh my goodness. Yeah, this is worrying about corn syrup in beer is kind of like, for people who think that vodka is a good source of potatoes or whiskey is a good source for rye or scotch is a good source for barley. This is really the height of inanity and I would say classic misdirection and diseased priorities. To put it simply, it's the alcohol, stupid. Alcohol kills over 100,000 people every year in America, and the majority of alcohol that's consumed in the U.S. is actually drank to abuse. It's probably not the concept we should be looking out for, people. And touching on another dietary crisis in America, from the Food Politics blog by Marion Nessel, supplements for pets. The market for supplements for pets is valued at around $2.6 billion, according to the National Animal Supplement Council. Without getting into details, just as with supplements for humans, little evidence exists to demonstrate that supplements do any good for pets, but they may make owners feel like they are doing something useful. Hey people, if you dearly love animals, stop eating them. And now, onto something we should be eating. From USA Today, child doctors have new advice on preventing dangerous peanut and food allergies. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that parents introduce some babies to peanut-containing foods to avoid dangerous allergies. The new guidelines calls for purposeful feeding in infants who are 4 to 6 months old and at high risk for developing food allergies. Perhaps because they have a relative with a food allergy, infant-safe forms of peanuts after solid foods have already been introduced. The general theory behind this is that getting the food into the body by eating is a way that the immune system usually initially learns to accept the food. The report replaces 2008 guidelines, further strengthening that there is no convincing evidence that delaying allergenic foods prevents food allergies. Beyond that, the report says there's no strong evidence that other common food allergens like eggs should be intentionally delayed. Now, I'd like to end with some good news from thehill.com. Fish from Ohio River that once caught fire, now safe to eat. Woohoo! Welcome to Ohio. Fish from a river in Ohio that gained infamy after it caught on fire due to pollution are now safe to eat. The Cuyahoga River in northeast Ohio that runs through Cleveland caught on fire in 1969 after years of waste from nearby steel mills filled it with contaminants. Federal environmental regulators gave the green light for fish from the river to be eaten again. The improvement is a huge step forward for the river and the region. If you can safely eat the fish, we know that's a great indication that water quality is improving, said Ohio EPA director. Yay, good news. Just for the health of it is also about the best in personal health information for you and your loved ones. Hearing about public health news can be challenging, even depressing, especially when there's little you can seem to do about it. But here at Just for the Health of It, we consider that a call to collective action. Fortunately, a lot of health is in areas where you have a lot more control. Nutrition is one of those areas where your personal choices can make a huge impact on your health. There's a lot of terrible nutrition information out there. Many sources of nutrition information are unreliable, leaving you to guess which half of the information is actually helpful. In general, I would say that if the source is trying to sell you anything, then you should be suspicious. Today, I want to share with you a resource that I use for reliable, science-driven nutrition facts. That would be nutritionfacts.org, a non-commercial, non-profit website that offers thousands of short videos, usually around 5 minutes long, giving reliable nutrition information on most any nutrition topic you might be interested in. WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo is a non-commercial site driven by personal passions and expertise offered freely to our community. Dr. Michael Greger, a physician trained in preventive medicine, is the founder and force behind NutritionFacts.org, a non-commercial enterprise. In this regard, Nutrition Facts is a soul sister to WAKT. Today, I want to read some excerpts from Dr. Greger's latest evidence-based eating guide. From the intro, Why Nutrition Matters. Most deaths in the United States are preventable, and they are related to what we eat. The number one cause of death in America is the American diet. Many people assume that our manner of death is pre-programmed into our genes. high blood pressure by 55, heart attacks at 60, maybe even cancer at 70, and so on. But for most of the leading causes of death, the science shows that our genes often account for only 10 to 20% of the risk at most. For example, when people move from low risk to high risk countries, their disease rates almost always change to those of the new environment. New diet, new diseases. But the reverse is also true. If we're eating the standard American diet and switch to a diet higher in whole plant foods, such as fruits and vegetables, this can lead to fewer diseases. Adhering to just four simple healthy lifestyle factors can have a strong impact on the prevention of chronic diseases. Not smoking, not being obese, getting a half hour of exercise a day, and eating healthier, defined as consuming more fruits, veggies, and whole grains, and less meat. Those four factors alone were found to account for 78% of chronic disease risk. Maybe it's time we stop blaming genetics and focus on the risks factors that are directly under our control. We have the power. It turns out a more plant-based diet may help prevent, and in some case even help treat or reverse, every single one of our 15 leading causes of death, including high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, and more. The inspiration for my work all started with my grandma. I was just a kid when my grandmother was diagnosed with end-stage heart disease and sent home to die. She already had so many bypass surgeries and was so scarred up inside that there was nothing more the surgeons could do. Confined in a wheelchair with crushing chest pain, her life was over at age 65. Then she heard of this guy, Nathan Pritikin, one of our early lifestyle medicine pioneers. And what happened next is chronicled in Pritikin's biography. My grandma was one of the death's door people. She arrived in a wheelchair. Mrs. Greger had heart disease, angina, and claudication. Her condition was so bad she could no longer walk without great pain in her chest and legs. Within 3 weeks, though, she was not only out of her wheelchair, but was walking 10 miles a day. And this is Michael Greger, the founder of Nutrition Facts, speaking. On my nonprofit website, nutritionfacts.org, I strive to read through every issue of every English language nutrition journal in the world, so busy folks like you don't have to. There are videos on more than 2,000 health and nutrition topics, all free, no ads, no products to sell, with new videos and articles uploaded every day on the latest in evidence-based nutrition. That does it for today's show. If you have feedback or ideas for the show, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. Again, that's wakt@toppun.com. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.